Remember, we got up to Daf Kuf Amud Aleph in the middle of the page, and we established that Reish Lakish accepts Rabbi Meir, and he's dying Dina the Garmi, which means if you show a coin to a money changer and he tells you that it's a reliable, valid coin, and then it turns out that he made a mistake, he has to pay out of pocket if you accepted that money and you took a loss based on his recommendation. That's called Doin Dina Degarmi. And now what we're up to is Hey Rabbi Meir, which again is about, about 10 lines down from the top. And we're going through an investigation of four possible candidate Mishnayos to find Rabbi Meir.
Before we go on, can I ask you, just to give a definition of Garmi and Grover.
Okay, so that's what this footnote is about. So you took the words right out of my mouth. Again, I think this is an excellent overview of what Garmi is all about. In the, we'll call it Roman numeral number one, is the opinion of Rashi and the Rambam. If you happen to want to write this down, it would be very helpful for you in the future. I have an extra penny. And according to Rashi and the Ramban, basically Garmi equals Groma. There's no difference between the two. And if you hold like Rabbi Meir, then in every case of Groma, you're chayev. If you reject Rabbi Meir, then in every case of Groma, you're potur. So whenever you see Groma benizikin potur, you know that that's referring not only to Groma, but also to Garmi, and that reflects the Shita against Rabbi Meir. When you see that Groma ben Ezekin is Chayav, basically you're saying Garmi. Amongst the objections that will arise in understanding Rashi and the Rambam Shita, which I call Roman numeral number one, is why does the Gemara use the language Garmi when it's just a case of Groma? Rashi and the Rambam don't have any distinction between the two concepts. They accept an absolute equation between the two. Then we go on to Roman numeral number two, which is the Ritzvah. The Ritzvah is one of the Bali Atosus in Bava Basra Chav Beizim and Beiz. And he and the Mordechai say that although Rashi and the Rambam are correct, that basically Garmi is Groma, but the language, the etymological difference between the two words is that in the case of Garmi, we're talking about a hezek matsui viragil. It's much more common, and therefore one should have anticipated that it would happen and take the proper precautions and care. Says the Ritzvah, since the case of Garmi is matsui viragil, it's very common and should have been anticipated. Therefore, Rabbi Meir says that although, in general, groma ben ezekin patur, but in the case of Garmi, by virtue of the fact that it is so common, they instituted a new halacha. This was a special takonas chachamim, and they were mechayev him to pay damages for Garmi. The drawback to Roman numeral number two is that it's very difficult to assume that there's more of a commonality in the cases of Garmi than in the cases of Groma. There are many cases of Groma which could be anticipated. For example, the classical case of Groma is where you open the fence and the animal goes free. Why is that less ragil than the case of a person who burns someone else's shtar, or the case of a person who breaks down a wall between two fields, as we'll soon see? Then we get to Roman numeral number three. And this is the opinion of an entire school of Rishonim, including, again, it's a who's list, we'll just call it Rov Rishonim for our purposes. And they hold that there's a fundamental difference between Garmi and Groma. And here's where it gets a little bit exciting. Says the following. What makes Garmi unique? And here he quotes the Levush. the Levush lived about 5 centuries ago, but he's basing himself on the Rishonim. Nezek Sheba Begram Karov Vehu Kimat Aso Biyadayim. In other words, the distance between what you did and the actual damage is very, very minimal. It's almost as if you did it directly. That's called garmi. But nezek begram rachok, meaning from your action A until the destruction of someone else's property is quite a distance. We'll see what that means. That's called gram rachok. That's called grama. Even when Rabbi Meir says Yechayev, he didn't mean that Yechayev for grama, which is a gram rachok. Are you able to hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, my voice is quite shaky, so as long as you can hear me. I actually asked the office if they had a microphone, but we're not on that madrigal yet. So that if you have a gram rachok, that even Rabbi Meir agrees is considered grama benizikin u patur. When does Rabbi Meir say Yechayev? In Garmi, that's what it's called, a gram korov. And the Levush goes on to explain that this, the nuances of the meaning etymologically of the word grama, where it's, you know, one and then two, as opposed to garmi, where it's almost a maisa biyadayim. What is the case of gram rachok, and what is the case of gram korov? So here he quotes the Rush. The Rush says the following. Again, it's kedai to see it inside if you have it. At least one person could grab it. Color code of Zacha. Okay, no buyers. That's okay. Kol shehu bi'atzmo oseh samaisa beguf hadover shel chavero. If a person picks up into his hands the object of his friend, at that point it becomes garmi. So he gives the example. When the Shulchani receives the coin into his hand, and then he declares that this coin is a valid coin, or alternatively, when a person picks up a document of his friend and then causes the destruction of that document, that's called, says the Rush, garmi, because that's already a gram karov. If a person never actually came in contact with the object of his friend, in other words, whatever contact he had with the object of his friend, it was purely innocuous. It did not in any way present even a logical possibility of a damage. And then the hezek ba mimela, but something else came and caused the hezek. So that you cannot consider the action of the mazik to be directly on the object that was nizak, that was destroyed. We'll have an example in just a second. Harezek grama benizikin upata. What's the case of a gram rachok? Oh. Ruvain holds on to a kli and of Shimon and climbs up to the top of, who can guess, the top of a
tree?
That's hard, but yeah, maybe a tree. But the class case talked of a roof, right? Top of the roof. And now he throws the kli down on a cushion. In other words, this action that he does is totally innocuous. Kevin Shahayu talked of Karim Uksusos. What's going to deflect the impact of the object coming down? It's the cushions, you know, these Karim Uksusos. Now Levi comes along and he removes the Karim Uksusos. And now the object in flight hits the bottom, crashes, and shatters to pieces. So he says the following. Ruvain, although he came in contact with the object, he didn't do any sort of maisa hezek on the object because he sent it down to the pillows. Shimon didn't do an action on the object. He never came in contact with the action. He simply removed the pillows that would cushion the fall of the kli. Therefore, even Shimon is considered patur. I forget if it's Shimon, maybe it was Levi, I'm sorry. Even the person who removed the Karim Uksusos is patur because he never came in contact with the object. So according to the Rosh, in order to traverse that gap between Maisa Hezek and Grama, you need a close contact which makes it like Asiya B'Yadayim. That's called a Gram Karov. And when is it Asiya B'Yadayim? When he takes the object into his hands and he does something to the object or about the object which will cause a loss. The Rush continues and he says that we have to add another condition to Garmi. It's not sufficient to say that he did an action on the object. We need another condition. It's got to be Bari Hezeka. The Hezek is Vadai. There's no question, it's absolutely certain, it's absolutely predictable. Aval Kol She'eino Bari Hezeka, Af Shehu V'Atzmo Osa Maisa B'Gufa Chefetz. Nevertheless, it's still considered Groma, and Groma ben Ezekin Potter. So for example, if let's say I took your shtar into my hands and I destroyed it, but the nitba, that means the lover, may or may not admit that he borrowed the money. If he admits that he borrowed the money, do we need the shtar or do we not need the shtar? We don't need the shtar. So in such a case, we're going to have to assume that it's not Bari Hezeka, and therefore it's only Grama ben Ezekin. When does Rabbi Meir say that it's Garmi and we jack it up to the level of a Maisa B'Yadayim because of Bari Hezeka? That's only if the Nitba, meaning the Lova, already denied the Chov up front, which means the Malva has no recourse to force the Lova to pay for this Alva unless he can produce what? The Shtar. If the Shtar is gone, that's called Bari Hezeka. So a later Achron, commenting on this Rosh, he's called the Marashdam. People think I'm related to him, I'm not. He came from a city called Berzhan, but that was in Galicia, my people from Lithuania. But in any event, the Marashdam says that you need both of these conditions in order for the Nezek to be considered and subsumed under Garmi. But if one of these conditions is lacking, either A, he, the Mazik, did not come into direct contact with the object, he never had any direct touching of the object, or B, it was not Bari Hezeka, it was not definite, then even Rab Meir would say that you're part. Hainu, Kishalohu bi'atzmo, Asa Maisa B'Guf HaDavar, Afal Pi, Shahezek Hu Bari. Oh, Kishahezek ba al yidei atzmo aval eno bari b'chol zeu groma bin ezikin upot. Now here the Marashtam adds another chidush, which honestly I need your help to understand this next chidush. The Marashtam wants to say that in the framework of the Rosh, the second condition to jack it up from Grama to Garmi, namely that it's Bari Hezeka, that applies when a Hezek ba miyat. If the destruction happens immediately, in other words, right away I can see that the Nizak has suffered the loss, then it can be considered as Bari Hezeka. But if there's going to be a time lapse between A and B, in other words, A is the Maisa of the Mazik, and B is the actual Hezek, and it's going to take a little bit of time, that's going to be considered Grama. That's not Bari Hezeka. And Rabosai, honestly, I'm at loss here. Why does the Marashtam assume so? Anybody have any...
Does he give an example?
I don't have the Marashtam. All I have is the Masifta, summarizing the Marashtam. I think you might go on to Bar Ilan and find the Marashdam. I don't know. So the only thing I could think of, Rabosai, is that if there's a time lapse, then the possibility always exists. Like, let's say, for example, you asked for an example, but this is Berzon's example. Not Berzon, but Berzon. what does the Berjana Rav have in mind? I think, let's say, I would take your kli and place it on the shore. And when the tide comes in, the waters are going to sweep away your object. So I think he's saying that that's Grom of Inezikin. And even though you and I might say, well, the tides are going to come, but since there's a time lapse, it becomes Grom. Why? Again, don't hold him responsible for this. But maybe someone will come along in the interim and pull the kli away. He won't be able to change the tides. That we don't have the power to do. But what he could do is perhaps save the kli before it's gone. Now, where do I get such a thing from? There's a sugya maybe you're familiar with in the second Perek HaBo Metzia, which is called Aveda Midas. Otherwise known as Zuto Shel Yam. And what it means is that a person lost an object in a way that it's a matter of time before the tide sweeps away the object and it's totally lost. And the Gemara says that even if it's a Dover Shesh Bo Siman, and even if I hold like a Baye that Yeyush Shalom Midas Lo Avi Yeyush, in this case even a Baye would agree, find his keepers. And why? Because that's called an objective avuda mimenu umikol adam. The Gemara then goes on to say that if somebody intercedes and grabs onto the object before the tide comes, he can keep it for himself. Why? Because the yeush is, so to speak, built into the object. Says the Marashdam, all this makes sense if the tide is about to come. Then it's avuda mimenu mikol adam. What are the chances that somebody is going to grab it? It's like the case of an object that was lost at the bottom of the sea. Maybe you could hire deep sea divers to retrieve it. But in the meantime, it's lost from anybody. Who's going to find something? Yeah, you lost the ring at the bottom of the sea. But if there's a time lapse, then according to this approach, that's not called Bari Azeka, because maybe in the interim somebody will come along and save it. That goes back to the principle of Yeush Shalom Idas. The loser doesn't realize that he dropped it on the seashore, you know, on the shore near the water banks, near the river banks. And if he would know it, he would be Messiah-ish, because what are the chances that somebody might save it? But in the meantime, the object is still very much alive and well. And if somebody comes forward and grabs it before the tides get there, that's called Lav Bari Hezeka. So keep that in mind as we go through the sugya. Now, one more comment before we go on. The Ramban, and he claims, Tosus as well, hold that Rabbi Meir, who says, Yechayev and Dina de Garmi, it's only a Knas de Rabbanan. This to me is the most revolutionary pshat. Again, it doesn't give us a fourth possibility as to what the difference between Grom and Garmi is. But it tells you something amazing, that fundamentally, even Rabbi Meir agrees that Garmi is Potter. But for whatever reason, depending upon how you define Garmi, the Shita of Rabbi Meir is that you have to pay and you're liable for Garmi. That's only a Knas Derabanan. Rabbi Osai, what principle are we activating here? Whenever you see Knas Derabanan, Hefker Bezdin Hefker. This must be Bezdin exercising their authority of Hefker Bezdin Hefker. And therefore, the Gemara now is going to try to show us. Now, as we go through the four Mishnayos, you won't see Rabbi Meir's name mentioned in three out of four, we'll double check. But there's a principle called Stam Mishnah Kerabbi Meir. So when there's no mention of any name, then we attribute that Mishnah to Rabbi Meir. So here's the first one. This one is perhaps the most complicated of them all. And honestly, I don't see how you get through this Mishnah without the help of the Masifta that I photocopy for you. The Snan, it's a Mishnah Masechta Bechoros, and the Mishnah says the following. Is there anyone here who's interested in seeing the Masifta inside? No one. I'm extremely disappointed, Rabbi Osai. I'm telling you, the research that he did here is amazing. I don't mind going to the... If there's one person who's interested... So what we've covered so far is page 1, footnote Chet, which is the entire left column of your page, that starts with Rashi and the Rambam, that there's no difference between Garmi and Groma. And therefore, if you hold Garmi is Chayiv, you hold that Groma is Chayiv. If you hold that Garmi is Potur, you hold that Groma is Potur. Then in the second paragraph, you'll see the Ritzbah, which is a Tosim Bava Basra and the Mordechai Bava Kama, that it all depends upon whether it's a Hezek Matsui Viragil, that jacks it up to the level of Garmi. Then in the third paragraph, you have Rov Rishonim, and they're of the opinion that if it's a gram karov, kimat ki'ilu aso biyadayim, so there's no delay factor between the action and the destruction that it caused, that's called garmi. But grama refers to a gram rachok. You have that? And then if you'll see, about two-thirds down in that footnote, in that paragraph, he quotes the tshuva of the Marashdam. And you'll find that there. Okay then? Mm-hmm. So without further ado, let's see the first of the four candidate Mishnayos. This not. This, he tells you, is a Mishnah Masechta Bechoros. That's a Masechta that I always wanted to learn, Be'iyun, I never got a chance. Is Dayan Shedon Es Hadin. Now, this is going to be an unbelievable Mishnah. The Mishnah is going to tell us that if a judge offers a ruling, hands down a ruling, and we're talking about monetary cases. In the first case, two cases is Zika Asachayov. You know, it's the party who really is liable to pay. He said he's off the hook. He exonerates him from any payment. Or in the flip case, Chiev Esazakai, the party who's really, truly supposed to be exonerated and free from payment. The ruling was handed down that he has to what? He has to pay. Okay? Then, Timei Es Hatar, right? There were foodstuffs that the ruling was handed down that it's Tomei, even though it's really Tar, or the opposite. The ruling was handed down that it's Tar when it's really in truth Tomei, Masha Asa Asui,
V'yishalim. You mean they found that later? You've made a mistake.
Right. So he handed down a ruling, and then we found out subsequent to the ruling that a mistaken judgment was made. The Yishalemi Beis. So Abosai, obviously, we have to ask two questions. Question number one: if the mistake was made, is Mashaasa Asui? That doesn't make any sense. We have a principle called Kara Mashanami Mishnah. If anyone makes a mistake, is Yachzar. We return the whole situation back to what it really should be, so that if he was metame as hatar, then we declare that this is tar. If he was metayer as hatame, then we have to declare that it's tame. It can't magically change and become tame just because he declared it to be tame. And if Reuven is chayv to pay Shimon, all right, the mistake was made, and the dayan felt that Reuven was off the hook. Now we know that he's chayv, let him pay. If he exonerated Shimon from payment, now we know that Shimon is liable, let him pay. So that's our first question. What's this Masha Asa? Asa. Ma tell me? Lo shamati, mita?
Mita. If they killed
mita?
One, yeah.
Hargu oto? Medubar dinei mamarot. Alright, now, what about the second question? I don't know if the second question is even worse than the first question. If the judge made an honest to goodness mistake, why does he have to pay from his pocket? Okay. So on both sides, let's take these two questions one at a time. What you want to look at is on page 2, footnote Yud Bet. So again, Rabosa, I could have given this all to you Balpeh, and hopefully your geniuses, so you would be able to absorb it all. But I think it's more meaningful if you see it inside, and you can take it with you, because this is something that you should have. He says the following. First of all, you have to know, and this is in the second paragraph, Mavur Kansha Ein Adayin Yochel Levatel Asadin Shel Hora, that Masha Asa means that we cannot undermine the original ruling, even though it was a mistaken ruling. Ulekach, and therefore, Ein Yochel Lechayves Atovea Lahachzir Samo Shekibel Shelo Kedin, because the ruling is irreversible, therefore we don't have the possibility of saying, hey, instead of the dayan paying out of pocket, let the plaintiff give back the money, cough up the money that he took illegally based on a mistaken ruling. Why? Because that ruling is irreversible, and therefore there's no recourse for the nitba, for the defendant to get back his money, unless the dayan actually pays a check from his own bank account. And similarly, if the ruling was in favor, the mistaken ruling in favor of the defendant, and the defendant went out of court, you know, dancing in the air because he doesn't have to pay, we don't now say, well, the defendant really has to pay, let him pay, but rather the dayan has to pay out of pocket to the plaintiff. As a result of this mistaken judgment, the nitba, who had to pay when he's really exempt, and that's in the first of the two cases, took a loss, and that loss has to be compensated by the dayan himself. Now, how do you have a loss in the case of Tuma Vitara? He says, Li'achar Shahora Bitos Ala Truma Tahora Shitmeya. He mistakenly gave the ruling about this truma that in truth, in reality, is not contaminated, that it's contaminated. Hora also kayemes. We cannot reverse this ruling, which we don't understand why. Vatruma asura b'achila. And now the owner of the truma has taken a tremendous loss, because what do you do with truma tmeya? You burn it.
Oh. That's why you can't reverse it,
Rabbi. Right, you can't reverse it, but why can't you reverse it if he made a mistake? It's not really Tome. He says the following. Hadvarim amurim kisheta b'shikul adas. So please make a note of this. There are two types of errors that a judge can make, and they're qualitatively and fundamentally different, categorically different. One is called tos b'shikul adas, and the other is called a tos b'dvar mishnah. As we'll soon see in the footnote, the Sugya Masechta Sanhedrin says that in the case, the latter case of a tos bidvar mishnah, then the ruling is overturned, it's reversed, as if it was never decided, it was never handed down. But our case, in the Mishnah in Bechoros, as opposed to the Sugya in Sanhedrin, is discussing a case of tos b'shikul adas. What is the difference between the two? Hainu, what is shikul adas? Dover sheyesh bo machlokas tanoim o amoraim. Okay, and the next few words are the key words, if you can underline them. Vilo nifsaka halacha kiman. Neither of these two opinions were accepted as the final ruling. Now we begin to understand, Rav Hosai, why this tos is not really an absolute mistake. On the contrary, what bothers our minds at this point, if we stop the discussion, is why is this a mistake at all? If he decided that I believed halacha and this machlokas is like so and so, why is that called a mistake? The halacha was never oiske paskin. They never came to any final conclusion and determination of the final halacha. Is therefore, he says, v'yos adayin ke'echad mehem, and the problem is the following. Here's where the dayan was unaware of something. His pashet haminog kedivrei ha'echad. Meaning, in the original sources, call it the Gemara, let's go back even as far as the Mishnah is concerned, there's no way that you could determine the final halacha. If you will, it's a kind of, I don't mean this literally, teiku, and the decision is left undecided, open-ended. However, Here's where minhag takes effect. The power of a minhag is that the minhag, whatever that means exactly within what radius of location, but the minhag determines the final halacha. Where did the dayan make his mistake? He was a baki b'shas. He knew all the mishnayos. He knew all the gemaras. You could test them. He went through shas at least 3 times. And he knows shas. But there was no conclusion in shas. What he was unaware of, v'lo yada dayan, shekfar nispashet ha-minog, he says, b'chol ha-olam. Okay, I don't know, that's a little bit questionable in my mind. I don't know why he has to say b'chol ha-olam, but anyway, he says b'chol ha-olam, kidivrei echad, acher, meaning the other one, not the guy that he paskin like. So he thought, logically, since the Gemara didn't come to any conclusion, I side with Reuven, right? Reuven's a Tana or an Amora. But the minog accepted the opinion of Shimon, a different Tana, different Amora. And the minog already caught like wildfire throughout the entire globe, and this Dayan was unaware of it. That's called Tos B'Shikul Adas, meaning that basically his Tos is not a Tos in something that is built into the halacha. His ruling was not an incorrect halachic ruling. The ruling itself is valid, and it's a chal shem horah. It has the status of horah to it. However, since the halacha was nispashet based on the minog, therefore, what happens is he's considered a toeh. So on the one hand, his psak is a chal shem horah. Is it a valid orah? Yes. My nafkimina? No. Before you get to that, you're a step ahead of me, Mitch. But what's the basic thrust here of saying that this orah that he gave is a chal shem orah? That it's irreversible. Again, that's our goal here, to understand why Masha Asa Asa. The answer to that first question, why is this irreversible? Are you willing to say that every mistaken ruling has a chal shem orah and it's irreversible? No. Aval dayin shetah b'dovar ha-mefurish b'torah harei ze ketos b'dvar mishnah v'adin chozer, and that's reversible. V'chol dovar mefurish b'talmud, if the Gemara comes to a definite conclusion, hilchasa ke man, that's a tos b'dvar mishnah, and that's not a valid ruling. His ruling is null and void. The af b'dover sheyesh lo machlokes, but im huchra b'talmud b'feirish, the Gemara comes to the conclusion, that's called ta b'dvar mishnah. V'chein, and take a look at this, ta adayin b'klolei apsak, we have a din that if there's a machlokes between Rabbi Akiva v'chavero, which means there's only one person who argues with Rabbi Akiva, he didn't realize mistakenly that we paskin like Rabbi Akiva, that's considered tod b'dvar mishnah, because we have a ruling that appears in the Talmud that halachik Rabbi Akiva mechavero. And by the way, Rabbi Osi, if you're ever interested in understanding all the klolim of psak given by the Talmud, the Encyclopedia Talmudit under the Erech Halacha Hei Lamed Chaf Hei has 40 pages just on this question: what are the rules of psak given by the Talmud? In any event, based on all those rules, if he made a mistake in judgment, his ruling does not have a chal shem orah; it's not valid. Harezu tos b'dvar mishnah v'chozer, and therefore the psak is reversible. But dover she'ena mefurash elashu pashut v'ein bo machlokes is harezu tos b'dvar mishnah. Now he has another category of tos b'dvar mishnah. He says, for example, if the mistaken judgment was because the judge equated two things, made an analogy, Dima Dayan Dover Ludover, the Ena Dome Lizek Klau. What a mistake. Again, I'd hate to think of a judge who makes such a mistake. Maybe he should be disbarred, but he equated apples and oranges. He says that's also Adin Choser, that's called a tos. So again, in our sugya, the tos is justified. What do I mean it's justified? Obviously he's responsible to know what the minhag is. But in terms of the halach itself, it's a valid halachic ruling because there was never any principle or any source, neither in the Talmud, nor in the Mishnah, nor in the Torah itself, that would invalidate his ruling. His ruling was basically his decision. It was a shikul hadas. That's valid. But if he's tov b'dvar Mishnah, then for sure that psak is reversible. Let's take a moment of time, Rabosai, and now go back to the Gemara itself. The Gemara says, and here I want you to open up page 1 of the 2 pages that I gave you, that in the case of Tier Es HaTomei, he established something which is really in truth Tomei as Tahar, is Masha Asa Asu. So if you take a look at footnote number Yud Aleph, which is on the bottom left of page 1, he says that Lechora, again, we'll see his answer, but let's just understand this question. This doesn't make any sense. If the object is really Tomei, and with this mistake in Shikul Hadas, he determined that it's Tar, how can you tell me about that ruling that it's irreversible? You're going to tell me that something that's Tomei is Tar just because magically he declared it as being Tar? Tzarech Lomar, Shabalabayis Irev Peros Elu Yachad and Peros Tahorim Acherim Shahayulo. That the case is that the Balabayis, based on the ruling of this Dayan, that this Tomei is really Tar, I mean, again, it's not really Tar, but according to the ruling, it's Tar, he went ahead and he mixed up these Peros into a mixture with other Peros Tahorim. Ukshinis bara ta'uso shalachacham nimtza sha'ata kol aperos heim tmeim machmas ha'ora hamuteis shalachacham. Wow. Do you know what happened over here? And this is really classical garmi. As a result of this mistaken ruling, again, the ruling itself is reversible. So we're going to see that in 3 out of the 4 of the cases, the ruling is irreversible. In 1 of the 4 cases, the ruling is reversible. But then you can ask me, if the ruling is reversible, why does the Dayan have to pay out of pocket? The answer is, we're going to reverse his ruling. That which he was metayer, we're going to now reverse, it's going to be Tomei. But in the meantime, based on the ruling, the Balabai is under the impression, based on the ruling, that it was Tari, mixed it in with other Peros. Now he was metami the whole mixture. Now what assumption is he working with? That there's no bittel, correct? That the ratio between the Tar and the Tomei is such that it's less than the shear of, let's say, Shishim, whatever the shear of bittel is, and therefore the whole mixture became Tomei. Now, let's go through our definitions of Garmi. If you're going to tell me Garmi is a Dovar Ragil, meaning it's something that we can predict, well, I think it's, in my humble opinion, I think it's fair to predict that if you tell something to sell somebody that his parents are Tahorim, what's he going to do with them? He's going to mix them in with the other. He has no reason to suspect otherwise. So for the element of what he calls the Ritzvah here, which was Roman numeral number 2, Hezek Matsui, Viragil, I think we can justify the Gemara's premise here that this comes under the Chiyuv of Garmi. However, according to Roman numeral number 3, which we're and Roman numeral number 1 is fine because Gromim and Ezekiel Chayim, according to Rabbi Meir, right? But now let's skip to Roman numeral number 3. It's got to be, according to Marashdam, in his understanding of the Rosh, it's got to be Miyad. I'm wondering how to understand this Gemara, why the Havmin is that he's Chayim Midinah de Garmi. Is that called Miyad? I find myself hard pressed to believe that this is Miyad. I mean, at the moment that he declared that this is Tar, the first thing the Baal did is he ran home, he got himself a whole pot of Peros, and he threw this in and he mixed it in. And that I find a little bit difficult to assume.
There's also no Biyadayim there.
Okay. So just 1 second, Zev. Mitch is asking a very intelligent question here, which I missed. In fact, Mitch, wait a second. According to the most Rishonim, in order to establish his garmi, he's got to be. Yeah. So the truth is, Mitch, I don't think the Gemara knows that secret yet. But that's going to be the Gemara's answer. Because your question is Gemara's answer. Okay. Take a look at the Gemara's answer for a second. And this is the basis of what we call Rov Rishonim in defining Garmi. Ha'itmar Allah, Omar Avilah, Omar Rav. Why is this Dayan held responsible and liable to pay damages? Shenatal v'nasan biyat. Okay, now we're going to need to go through footnote number Yud Gimel, which is on page 2, in order to understand the Gemara, you know, word for word. But what we do know is that the Dayan actually took the peros into his hand. Okay, that's going to be the basis for the shita of Rov Rishonim, that Garmi is only chayev if he took it into his hand. However, I just want to point out that according to the Maharaj Dam, I'm not sure why Bari Azeka, in order to make it into Garmi, requires Miyad and had to fulfill that requirement in this fourth case of Tiras Atomi. That's just my comment. Yes, sir.
Maybe the Miyad is opposed to putting it on the shore. Maybe Miyad, as opposed to putting it on the shore, and the tide will come at a later time, the moment he puts the fruits with the fruit that is tahor, instantly it all becomes tummy.
Right, but I'm just saying that the ruling of the Dayan came at time T1. Did at that second the Dayan take that, you know, that peros, those peros which he declared to be tar, and throw them into this mixture? The Balabais was very happy to hear that his peros are tahorim. He came home, and in the course of time, he threw it into an entire vat of peros tahorim. It's hard to say that that's exactly miyad. Even if I don't accept the Maharsh Dam, I'm still in trouble because the Rosh insists that it's got to be Bari Hezeka. I don't know if you could say it's Bari Hezeka. Again, it's close to Bari Hezeka, but I'm not sure if it's totally definite. So I'm just pointing out here that, you know, we're going to have to do a little bit of fetching here now that we're such scholars and we understand what Garmi is meant to be, to figure out the Shakal Vitaya in this Gemara. Now, let's go through the three cases. The first case is Zika Es HaChayo, okay, which means that, let's say if Reuven is the plaintiff, if Shimon is the defendant, the ruling of the Dayan was that Shimon does not have to pay. And in truth, Shimon does have to pay. Again, all based on the Tos B'Shikol Hadas that we discussed before. The second case is Chiyav Es HaZakai, which means that the ruling was that Shimon, the defendant, doesn't have to pay when in fact he does have to pay. And then we have the third case of Timei Es HaTar. So look, in the case of Timei Es HaTar, I don't have the same problem that we had here in this Tosus that was quoted before, because we don't have to change the reality here. In other words, if the ruling of the Dayan has a Chal Shem Ora, then there is room to assume that this is Tomei. Again, since the Minog is not like that, the Bailim, the owner of these fruits, suffered a serious loss, because what are they going to do with this Truma other than burn it? And therefore the Dayan has to pay out of pocket. Now I had one thing to add here, which I wrote down on a notebook, but of course I forgot to bring in the notebook. I left it, I think, on my desk, but okay. So hopefully I'll remember what I wanted to tell you. Now, what does the Gemara mean here? We're up to page 2, when it says that Natal v'nasan biyat. So if you'll take a look on the bottom right, which is footnote number Yud Gimel, he says the following. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do, if you want to play this game with me, is to not look too far ahead. Because the next paragraph is going to answer a question, but I want to see if we can come up with that question on our own. Okay then? What's the case in the Gemara, according to Rav, of Natal v'Nasan Biyad? He says the following. The first of the four cases was Chiev Esazakai. So what's Chiev Esazakai? Right, we said that the defendant was found guilty. And what happened here? Once the defendant was found guilty, the dayan took the money from the hands of the defendant and he passed it on to the plaintiff from the nitba over the tovea. Case number two, Zika es hachayav. What does it mean that he said that the nitba, the defendant, is free of is guiltless of the charge against him, and he made a mistake. So what did he take? What did he take out of someone's pocket here? You know, he said to the lover, let's call him, that he doesn't have to pay. So what did he do? Oh, midubar shela malve haya mashkan. The love gave a, what's it called in English, a security deposit over to the hands of the malve. What did the dayan do when he found the love to be exempt from payment? Not low, he took the mashkan out of the hands of the malve and he returned it to the hands of the love. And again, since that ruling is valid, as we said over and over again, therefore the love doesn't have to return the mashko, nor does he have to pay the talva. Then we go on to the next case. Betime es hatar. What does he mean? The dayan went ahead, and after he declared that this tar is tame, is heviu es hataros lefanov kidei lishol aleihem liachar sheposek shem tmeos notal sheretz v'noga behem. Okay, now don't look weiter for a second. What question are you going to ask here? Does anybody bothered here by what I call a kindergarten child should ask the question?
He's Natami himself.
Why did he do such a thing?
To make sure that we're...
That is in Gansin Meshuggah. The dayan takes this fruit and he takes a sheretz and he touches it. So hold on to the next paragraph of Tama Dover. And finally, in the case of TRS HaTame, he decided that this Tame is Tahar. Medubar Shadayan Notal Saperos, Ve'irvam Imperos Shalanisha. Okay, I can see that. Maybe he wanted to, you know, demonstrate how convinced he is. So he said, let's put it into this mixture. Everything is tar, go home and be happy about it. V'tama dovar, the next paragraph. Here we have a Ramban. The Ramban changes our entire understanding of the sukkah. We've been saying over and over again that because he made a toast in Shikol Adas, the Hora is a Chal Shem Hora, and that's why it's irreversible. Says Rabban Teitzo. Tam Adover. The Vinosan, Vinosa Vinosan Biyad Chayov. What is this extra pula that the Dayan does? It's totally crazy. I would have said to the Dayan, quit while you're ahead, don't get involved. Mishum da'al yidei pu'ula zu kibla ha'ora tokef gomur v'eino chozeris. Zok the Ramban, an amazing finish. There are two types of ha'ora b'shikol adas. There's a ha'ora b'shikol adas of dibur b'alma, and then there's ha'ora b'shikol adas with ha'ora that was followed up by what? By a maisa, by a pu'ula. What's the nafkamina? Says the Rabban, a toast b'shikol adas is chozer. You misunderstood the whole sugi. When is a toast b'shikol adas eino chozer? When the diet does a maisa. Again, we're going to have to rack our brains and figure out why. But we begin to understand what the diet was trying to demonstrate here when he took that extra step and he grabbed the mashkin out of the hands of the malvin. He grabbed the money out of the hands of the lover. He took the taros, which he declared, which are tmeim, and he declared him taros, and he threw it into a mixture. He took a sheretz and he added it to the tar, which is really tar, but he declared it as tamei. With all due respect to this Dayan, and he made an honest to goodness mistake in Shikla Das, the Gemara had no conclusion on that machlokas, but that doesn't give him the ability, the authority to create a chaloshem hora that's such that it's irreversible. Ad? What upgrades and clinches the chaloshem hora, making it irreversible? Ache yasa maisa aldino kimavuar midvarav she'ein chazoras hadin tliya b'chiyuv hadayin el shim lo nasa v'nasa biyad lo hichzik hadayin kol kach es dvarav ulefichach hadin chozer avalim asa maisa yofekoch hadayin. So that's what we got up to until this point. What do we have so far, Abosai? Just to summarize, the first attempt to establish the authorship of the Mishnah of Rabbi Meir as a reflection of Garmi has failed. Why does it fail? Because the only way that the entire discussion of Tashlumin could come into being is conditional on the fact that the Dayan did a Maisa. If the Dayan did a Maisa, that Maisa of taking a Sheretz and putting it onto something that's tar is an act of Hezek. Lomi boy, according to Rabbi Meir, holds Dayan Dina Garbi. Forget about Rabbi Meir. It's called Hezek Mamish. It's an absolute direct Maisa Hezek. Vehu Adin, when the Dayan takes the Mashkon from the hands of the Malveh and he passes it on to the Loveh, etc., etc., etc. This has nothing to do with Dayan Dina the Garmi. Ela, Harabi Meir, with this we'll have to conclude. This Nan, the Mishnah later on, we're coming up to it, says that if you give a, we'll call it raw wool, natural wool, to a dyer, litzvah lo adom, mitzvah shachar, shachar mitzvah adom, Rabbi Meir Omer, no sein lo, demei tzamro. Even though, mind you, he improved the wool, but not according to the commission that was given to him. He was asked to dye it red and he dyed it black or vice versa. Nevertheless, he has to pay damages on the wool. And that's called gazlan. He is considered a gazlan. Here he's commissioned to be an umad and to fulfill his agency on behalf of the owner, and at the end he turns out to be a gazlan. Says Rabbi Meir, why is he a gazlan? I mean, this is only Grum and Benizikin. In fact, the value of the wool has increased, has enhanced on the market. Says the Gemara, Hasam ka'avin biyadayim. The act of destruction was done directly. This was not an indirect grama or garmi. This was a maisa hezek mamish. And therefore, even if I hold that garmi ben ezikin patur, in this case you'd be chayim. The question I want to leave with you, which we'll pick up Mirtz Hashem next time, is what was the Gemara thinking in the Hamavita? Didn't the Gemara realize that this is a case of hezek mamish? This is maisa biyadayim. He took the wool, and instead of dyeing it red, he dyed it black. apparently that's not called a Maisa Hezek Mamish, because on the market a black wool is worth a lot of money. It's worth a lot more than natural wool for those people who like black dyed wool, or vice versa in the case of red wool. I thank you all for persevering and for your great desire to see the photocopy, and I thank you also for wishing me a refuah shleima, and I'm getting right into bed now for the weekend, and everyone should have a great Shabbos. Thank you so much.